Now to social media and breaking news. It can be very good. It offers the enormous advantage of making anyone with a smartphone into a reporter. With hundreds of millions of smartphones out there, that's quite a newsroom. But it can also be very, very bad, with rumours circulating quickly and completely false information rapidly gaining a wider currency. Alfred Hermida, who used to be at the BBC and now works for the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of British Columbia, has been researching this very issue. He says the problem doesn't lie with the technology.
Well, I think you're blaming the tool rather than the way people use it. It's like saying people are using the telephone in a bad way. Really, it's also how we approach Twitter. What you tend to find when it comes to breaking news is there's sort of patterns in how messages emerge. So one of the things that the research shows is that a message that has correct information will spread very gradually. And whereas one that has false information tends to spread very slowly at the beginning and then has a spike. So as a journalist, you could look at that and say, perhaps it's not quite as credible.
Well, let's, drill down to it. But before we do, can you give us some egregious examples of mainstream media wrongly taking social media at its word, not doing the verification, and amplifying something that's just wrong?
With the LA shootings, the Globe and Mail picked up a tweet that said that former chief of the NSA had been killed in the shootings. It came from an account that looked like it said headline news. Now, this was seen by a reporter, it was passed to the editorial web team, it was passed to a homepage editor, it went to a senior editor, and the Globe and Mail in Canada published a story saying this former chief of the NSA had been shot and killed at the airport. It was a hoax account. Anybody checking the account would have seen that it was just created and there was only one tweet on that account. So you almost have some very basic techniques looking, check the source, look at, say, the Twitter account. How long has it been there? How many messages have they sent? Who follows them? Who do they follow? And by sort of doing this background research, you can get a sense that, no, this is either a real message or it's a hoax account. In this case, the Globe and Mail was caught out by a hoax account.
You break down this verification into several approaches, and the first is message-based analysis. Now, how does that work?
Well, we look in terms of what do people say in these messages. What you find is when somebody's caught up in a shooting or a natural disaster, they don't write in terms of journalese. They don't put breaking news, earthquake strikes, wherever, as a journalist would. They tend to just go, oh my God, I've been caught up in an earthquake. The messages have grammatical errors, the punctuation is all wrong, because their priority at the time is not to write a perfectly crafted message, but basically to get the news out. And what you also see is swearing. So usually when something dramatic happens, people tend to swear. So again, if you see a message with swearing, with grammatical errors, chances are it's likely to be credible. Of course, the same thing, if we did that on the ABC, we would not be seen as credible. But the opposite is on social media. Punctuation mistakes, swearing, adds to the credibility and authenticity of a message.
What about checking pictures or photos? Because there have been examples, haven't there, of claims that this is a news event that's just happened. And it turns out that photo was actually taken 10 years ago somewhere else.
And even the BBC has been caught out in that kind of scenario. So emerging best practices look in terms of, very often now when you have a picture, you can use something like Google Maps to check the location. You can check the weather at the time. You could look at the time of day, where the shadows are, to get a sense of the time of day of the shot. So there's a lot of clues in the message, in the picture itself. And by triangulating that with weather information, existing photographs of the location, it can give you a sense of, is this a real image taken at this particular place at this particular time?
There's also user-based analysis, and I suppose the best way of doing this is that oldest of journalism practices, which is talking to the source.
Yes, but really that is only the start of it, because with digital media, we always leave a trail. So whenever we do anything, we leave a little trail of clues. And as journalists, you can go into that. Certainly on Twitter, you can look and see how long has somebody been on Twitter. What tends to happen is sometimes the hoax accounts, the spam accounts, are set up immediately after a breaking news event. So if somebody has just come on Twitter, it might be an indication that they're not quite as credible as they should be. But also that you can then look at their digital trail, their past tweets, their retweets. If somebody's claiming to be in a particular city, you can say, well, have they mentioned that city in previous tweets? And that, again, helps you get a sense of whether that person is authentic beyond just talking to them, because you can look back and say, well, what was the digital trail they left? And what does that tell me about that person?
You have talked about a particular example of this, about an account that was supposed to be that of the Prime Minister of Libya, turned out not to be at all.
No, and it was a professional account. It looked like it had been verified by Twitter, but it was a hoax account. But what added to the credibility is that people like the British Foreign Secretary, William Hague, were following the account, and lots of journalists were referencing it. But when you looked back at the messages, you could see there was one message that referred to making all Libyans, turning them into tree-hugging hippies. Now, it's highly unlikely the Libyan Prime Minister would send a tweet like that. You wouldn't expect Tony Abbott to send out a message saying, I'm going to turn all Australians into tree-hugging hippies. And that, again, sets off alarm bells. In some ways, it's common sense. Look back and see, what did they say in the past? Is it consistent with who they say they are?
Right. So don't trust that somebody is genuine just because someone you know to be genuine is following them.
No, and that's part of the puzzle here, because sometimes you may look and say, well, who is following them? And if somebody who's genuine is following a hoax account, it does lend a veil of credibility. So you don't want to just rely on one thing. You want to look at all these different aspects and then see, when I piece together all these clues, what do they tell me about this person and the information they're sharing?
Alfred, you also talk about something called topic-based analysis. What does that involve?
Well, that involves taking a step back. Whenever there's a big event, you'll see a surge in messages around that topic. So these are signals, again, that you can look and see, what are they saying? So during the London riots of 2011, the politicians, the police, the press, they were very quick to blame social media for inciting the riots. But actually, when people analysed more than 2.5 million tweets, what you found is there were very few messages that incited people to violence. Most, in fact, were about the cleanup or about coordinating the response. So when we take this aggregate view, when we look at what is happening in the network, we get a very different picture. And that can help us, again, figure out what's closest to the truth here. Sometimes, as journalists, we see something that just seems so perfect, we want it to be true. And we sort of seek information to confirm it, whereas what we should be looking at is information that contradicts it. One of the interesting things that happens in terms of looking at sort of how people discuss the topic or looking at how a message spreads is very often there'll be a wave of corrections to try to fix the false information that's spreading. But again, it's hard to detect those corrections using the current tools we have.
There's also propagation-based analysis. Now, this I don't know about at all.
So this really comes out of computer science and looking at how messages spread. So speed can also be an indicator of credibility. So here what you see is this weird scenario where messages that tend to be credible are spread slowly over the network. So they're spread by people who already have a well-developed network of followers. So the message spreads steadily across the network. Fake messages tend to be sent out by accounts with very few followers. So initially, they don't go very far. But as soon as a journalist or somebody else who has significant followings latches onto it, suddenly you see a spike in that message. The other thing is also cross-checking accounts. What we've seen in politics is the use of Twitter for dirty tricks. So somebody might set up a series of fake Twitter accounts, and suddenly these will all start sending the same kind of political message, giving the idea that there's a groundswell of public opinion. But then you can trace it back and say, well, this came out of a handful of accounts that were all sending broadly the same thing, but retweeting each other to give the idea that there was a groundswell of opinion, say, against a particular politician.
There's also crowdsourcing the verification, which is when you get your social media friends or followers to help with the checking. And you have talked about the example of Andy Carvin from NPR and his work in the Arab Spring. He was on this show at the time, or just afterwards. And one of the things I was struck by talking to him is that he doesn't identify as a journalist first and foremost. And I wonder if that actually helped him, enabled him to kind of put it out there and ask for help in the way that somebody who does think of themselves as a journalist is less likely to.
Well, I think journalists come to this with the idea that I will go out, I will gather the information, talk to people, come back, make sense of it, write my piece, put my radio piece together, and then publish it. But what Andy Carvin did is he doesn't look at social media as a way to gather information, but rather as his newsroom, looking to the network of people he has to help him sort through fact from fiction. And I think this is where it becomes really interesting, because it means the journalist isn't the one that's sort of the sole person of authority there, but rather more as a coordinator, as a facilitator, trying to marshal people together and saying, well, I may not have all the answers, but there's probably somebody in my network I'm connected to who does. But it does mean the journalist has to be much more open and accept that they really don't have all the answers. They do not know everything.
That's a good point to finish, I think. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Richard.
Alfred Hamid is a digital media scholar at the University of British Columbia. And this is The Media Report with me, Richard Adie.